Now let's consider a historical system which was sometimes called the classical gold standard. In its simplest form, a gold standard means that a piece of paper money, such as a US dollar or a British pound, is convertible into a fixed amount of gold. But the classical gold standard was a bit more complicated and a bit more specific than that. Often the phrase the classical gold standard is used to refer to a very specific period of time, something like 1870 to 1914, when a fairly large number of nations were using gold as a backing for their money. There's also a broader notion of the classical gold standard involving fewer nations, but it can be dated back to 1821, when Great Britain decided to return to gold after the Napoleonic Wars. This ended in 1914 because of the First World War, and for more on that, see our video on the gold exchange standard. Different countries experienced the classical gold standard in some diverse ways. So pretty strictly on the standard were Canada, Australia, France, Germany, and the United States during this period. Italy was a more complicated story. They have a mixed record, and they were also using silver as a money. You then had countries such as Portugal and Spain, which weren't technically on the gold standard, but shadowed it. And then there were countries which left the gold standard, and I'll mention those later. Of special importance for the classical gold standard was Great Britain, and in particular the Bank of England. The Bank of England was a kind of shadow central bank for the classical gold standard. It sometimes served as a lender of last resort, and more generally it helped define and enforce the informal norms which were behind the system. The classical gold standard as we know it could not have existed without the Bank of England having had this central role in international finance. There really were some significant advantages to the classical gold standard. For instance, countries on the standard had more trade between each other, by some estimates up to 30% more. Being part of the classical gold standard, in a way it certified governments, it signified that they were going to repay money they might borrow in reliable fashion without devaluing the worth of their currencies. Overall, the system was predictable and rules-based, which the world needed very badly at that time. And you can think of the classical gold standard as simply being a pretty systematic and well-thought-out attempt to create some kind of international monetary order. Overall, I think of the classical gold standard as one of the great achievements of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. To be sure, the classical gold standard also had some notable disadvantages. One of these was simply deflationary pressures. One issue might be that the world as a whole was not producing enough gold to overcome some pressures of deflation. But you also could have deflationary pressures directed at individual nations when there was a tendency for gold flows to leave one nation and go to another. Keep in mind, this notion of the gold standard as being rules-bound and regulated by market forces, it meant that in particular points in time, individual nations were not always getting the monetary policies they desired. The classical gold standard also could mean periodic crises. Either gold would be leaving your country or about to leave your country, which perhaps would put pressure on your central bank or your banks to raise interest rates, which would in turn damage economic growth and could lead to other problems within the nation. Or you could let the gold leave your country and have a crisis of convertibility, which then mixed in with financial crises. And overall, when you put together the financial crises and the deflationary pressures, this was far from an ideal system. But I would simply stress the point, whether or not you favor a gold standard today, we're talking about the late 19th century here, and whatever advantages over a gold standard the modern world may right now have, it probably was not possible to recreate those during the time of the classical gold standard. A key theoretical notion for understanding the workings of the classical gold standard is what's called the price-specie flow mechanism. And for more on that, see our videos on David Hume and also Isaac Gervais in the Great Economist section. But you can think of the price-specie flow mechanism as simply outlining the principles under which gold is distributed to different nations. So in a world where there are no transportation costs for gold, we would expect that the value or the purchasing power of gold is the same everywhere, and that as prices across different nations diverge, gold will then move or flow across borders to bring those prices back into a more general equilibrium. However, in a more realistic setting, the price of transporting gold across borders is not zero by any means. There is a concept known as the gold points, and the gold points are kind of bands on the exchange rate that if exchange rates across different currencies, such as, say, the British pound and the French franc, were to be different by only small amounts, it would not be worthwhile shipping the gold from one country to another to try to arbitrage the differences in price levels. But if that difference in exchange rates and prices became large enough to move outside the gold points, we were then back into a setting where the gold would be shipped. So we thus, within the classical gold standard, had a kind of dual system. As long as prices and exchange rates were fluctuating within those gold points, you actually had some autonomous domestic monetary policy, and domestic economies were somewhat insulated from the international rules which governed the classical gold standard as a whole. But again, at some margin, if the value of gold across, say, Great Britain and France were to differ enough, whether due to changes in exchange rates or prices, well then, the incentive would be to transfer gold from one nation to another, and the rules-bound nature of the international gold standard and those market forces would again come into play, and very strongly. This is what was underlying the entire system. There were also some rules of the game, or supposed rules of the game, as to how discount rates would work. So let's consider an example. Say that you have an individual nation which is short on gold reserves relative to its economic setting. Well, the recommendation would be that that nation should raise what was called, in England, its bank rate, and this would be done by the Bank of England. Other interest rates in England would follow. Those higher interest rates would then attract gold from abroad, and that would limit the extent now to which Great Britain would be short on reserves. It also would mean, because you had higher interest rates, that would lower investment, that would bring an economic contraction, that would lower domestic output, and it would lower prices in Great Britain. And that would be part of the price specie flow mechanism of adjustment, because lower prices would mean more exports from Great Britain. That lower domestic output, that lower domestic purchasing power, that would mean fewer imports. So there would be a surplus of exports over imports. That too would mean that more gold would flow into the country. And that, at least supposedly, would help restore or reverse this initial problem of England being short on reserves. But please note, by no means did everyone do this, and in fact, the Bank of England was the institution that stuck most closely to these rules. The clearest examples of countries which didn't follow those rules at all, well, that would be Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, and when they faced gold outflows, they didn't want to have to raise their interest rates, and they fell off the classical gold standard and moved back to systems with weaker or no convertibility. I've listed here some key sources on the classical gold standard. These are available online. In general, the works of Michael David Bordeaux on this period and on this analysis are considered to be quite excellent. Googling the keywords is also useful, and Wikipedia as well has notable resources, and see the other videos mentioned throughout this discussion.